So, last couple of days at the monastery, we were talking about, at tea time, we were talking about synchronicities and how synchronicities often pop up, especially the more you meditate, the more you're, especially if you go on a kind of a spiritual path where your identity, your normal identity is kind of getting lost, a strange, odd, meaningful coincidence keep happening. So I'll tell you one that just, at the top of the stairs, when you go up the stairs, read, there's, look at the bulletin board. There's, down in the left-hand corner, it's this little poem. Your mind is a garden. Your thoughts are seeds. You can raise flowers, or you can raise weeds. Go figure. Yeah. So I'm not so original after all. I think the whole project for the last 10,000 years, I suppose, since the agricultural period has been a gardening project. So it's not surprising that the ideas would crop up in poems and literature and so forth, that all life is kind of like gardening. And of course, in the West, the seminal story, which is how it all started, isn't it? What is it? Adam and Eve in the garden. But it's very interesting. The story is very interesting. Yeah, a Buddhist monk analyzes the Old Testament. So the story is they are in this garden, but, and it's very beautiful, obviously, it's just wonderful, but they're in it unconsciously, unself-consciously, and are kind of in a state of continuous ecstasy. They don't have any, they're not dragging any burdens or past or future with them either. They're just at ease in the garden. But they're there, they just arrived. They don't know how they got there or why they're there. And they're just following their natural instincts. And then, of course, things go wrong. Sideways, and they eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. They start to have a sense of moral distinction, have a sense of guilt, and at that point they're expelled from the garden, and the complicated part begins. Remember, they try to get back in, and there's something prevented. There's an angel not allowing them back in. There's a kind of an angel with a burning sword, and they want to go back, but now they can't. They've lost something, and it's a natural state of ecstasy and ease. And it's interesting to reflect that. Now you can consider this story to be childhood, the innocence of childhood, and then we become, at some point, we become conscious and sophisticated, and then we do lose our innocence, and we can't seem to get back to the kind of the direct enjoyable state, unself-conscious state of childhood. And we, most of us, think it's gone forever. But the possibility of returning there is, meditation is the journey back also to the garden. And it's, I think in the Western tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition also, basically the end of the whole book is really the return to the garden, return to sort of paradise. They have it as symbolized as Christ. he's finding his way back into some sort of relief from all of the, you know, guilt and conflict and problems and so forth. And he advises that, you know, if you come by him, not, I don't think he ever meant it personally, but come through the, this type of consciousness can take you back to Adam, back to the garden. But you get back by, not by innocence this time, but by wisdom. And there are, I think there are kind of lifestyles and parts of your life perhaps that were pretty happy and light and free, but probably you didn't know why. You were a fortunate circumstances, had good people surrounding you, and weren't, just felt confident and so forth. But then things can happen, and you get kicked out of that garden. And so was the way back in, the only way past that angel with the burning sword is the is through a sword itself. Sword of wisdom is represented as a sword. Thing cuts through things, and we can find our way back. But we're, it's not by craft or trickiness. We can't take anything like that into a state of perfect ease. Even the smallest sense of inauthenticity makes us self-conscious and separates us from ourselves. So it has to be genuine. And so what we would say at the root of it is this sila is a virtuous, a quality of virtue. And virtue, of course, is to something to do with behavior, boundaries and behavior, but it really it has to be rooted in the good heart in order for it to be authentic and genuine. So the good heart also brings you back to freedom from all of the, you know, the fears and so forth, because you can't really have a good heart that's afraid, anxious, worried for the future, for the past. So there's something, a level of courage, at least to begin with, in the good heart. And there's a lot of talk in all spiritual traditions about death and immortality. I mean, literally, wasn't it at, so Adam and Eve are kind of immortal to begin with. They're not conscious of their mortality. But then once they gain wisdom, they also gain a sense of self. And with that comes the awareness of their own mortal nature. So they now are subject to death. So that's maybe a brilliant, and I, you know, the people who wrote these things down, I don't think they were in any way naive. I don't think they ever thought these stories were literal. I think they were just never thought anybody would think they were literal. They were, why would you, you know, have a whole poetic, haven't you ever heard of poetry, you know? Have you never heard a story before? Story about truth, not a true story, but a story about truth. That's the way it goes, you know? So it's only in modern times that we ever think that people were dumb enough to take things literally. So but we're the ones that seem to have taken it literally. So we just have to, well, any of these stories, we have to just like, what does that mean to me? What is my experience of life? And it's just the weirdness of like death. What is it? Death. Death arises. When I come into existence, when my sense of self comes into existence, with it is accompanied a sense of fragility and vulnerability, mortality. The animal is not sort of developing a sense of self. He doesn't have a... the dog is not thinking about himself, so he doesn't have any sense of mortality. But it's with this artificially created structure called myself. And you can see that it's artificial because people around you talk about themselves in certain ways, and you think you're sitting at tea with them, and right. No, you're nothing like that, you know. Like, you think, really? You know? No. No. And there's a normal spectrum, and then there's the abnormal spectrum, and it's pretty obvious in the abnormal spectrum. When somebody tells you they are actually Napoleon in disguise, and you ask them, why are you working at the snack bar at the psychiatric institute then? I'm in disguise, I told you. So then you think, okay, delusion. Now you can see, well, at least we can, in our extreme examples, we can see, it's clear to everybody that this construction that they've got going there is a delusion. But the Buddha says, you know, really all constructions of self are delusion. Some of them are more compatible with reality. So if you say, I'm not an angry person, then you're basically not an angry person. Then there's a sort of correspondence between your sense of self and your actual actions and speech and so forth. But this is a fabrication, an idea fabricated by the mind. And it becomes so real, we cannot question it. But this is exactly what we're trying to do with meditation, is to question ourself. In Tibetan culture, spiritual culture, they have what they often talk about as the most important question is who are you? And so your guru, your teacher would give you this question. Go out, answer me this question. Who am I? So you go off, who am I? Who am I? Who am I? And you keep coming back with, sometimes you, at first you think that he wants a real answer. So you keep, I am natural. I am a human. I am this, I am that. And he keeps saying, nope. And then you, wait a sec, I gotta get, maybe, let's see. Now, who am I really? Because it does seem there should be an answer, but eventually you exhaust the possibilities and you realize you can't answer that question. There is no. You're not somebody. There is no self. But you won't know that unless you really seriously question the whole who am I? And in modern, it's just an ordinary literature and so forth, these are the kind of questions your anguished hero asks themselves as they go through the novel or whatever it is. But they get answers, and that's the problem. So they answer it. There's still an assumption that you're going to get an answer. It's just that you're muddled at the time, but your real self, your authentic self is when you need to find that authentic self, and then you'll be at ease. So they're partially inquiring, and authenticity and something more in line with your basic human nature is going to give you some more peace and ease. But ultimately, the deeper inquiry is that you cannot get to it. You cannot find even the authentic self. At that point, immortality appears. Because there's only mortality, there's only death when there's somebody to die. And that is a concept, like somebody goes through time. The same one that went to sleep last night wakes up this morning. The one that was there 5 years ago, who did some rather unskillful things, which plagues your conscience to this day, is you. That's the way we feel, but that's a fabrication and a sense of identity which travels through time unchanged and is at core the same day after day, the one behind the changes is one. But this is not, you cannot find that one. But it plagues you because you identify with the past. At the same time you say, I'm not that person anymore. it's a very confusing. The Buddha is always, the Buddha is asking you to say, you know, telling you basically that let go of the past. You're not that. You're not whoever did those things, not you. Maybe it's more like your younger brother did it, went on the credit card binge, and just because you're related, you kind of have to pay the credit card debt off. But it wasn't you. It's not you. As long as you wouldn't do it again, then it's not you. So there is some sort of relationship to past actions, but it's not. There's no actual identity. You're not tied in truly to that. There's a flows of thoughts and impulses at the time, operating out of your limited wisdom and understanding. You do things which later on, as you become wiser and kinder and more learned, then you find those types of thoughts and speech and actions as kind of embarrassing or lesser. Sometimes, of course, we look back on things that we did well, you know, that we had clarity and we exercised the best possibilities, and we look back on them with pleased, you know. But however it is that we, this is our meditative practice, is to have these kind of themes going on, that recognizing the how we buy into the story of the self, this story of the self. And how, whatever the self is that we construct, does, along with it comes some problems. And they're better, they're more skillful, and there's less skillful types of self-images, but they're all images. At the bottom, though, the Buddha says some interesting, a few phrases throughout the huge collection of recorded talks by the Buddha through his 45 years of teaching. He says a lot of things, and one of them is that, and it's quite often repeated, it doesn't occur very often, but it's an interesting phrase or two, that he says that the it's the nature of the mind, the original mind, the mind in its original nature. Now, that you shouldn't think of it as a kind of a permanent or pre-existing self or soul or something like this, but more or less like water is intrinsically H2O. Of course, if you drink contaminated water, you get sick, or if there's mud in the water or anything like this, then it's tainted. But the H and the 2 and the O are not actually involved in it. They're always just H2O. They're not something else. So if you can allow the sediments and everything to settle, then the nature of water is pure. It is H2O. Same with the mind. So the mind has got stuff mixed into it. But its essential nature, that which it will return to, is pure, untroubled, with it, and free. And so there you get the kind of like Adam and Eve kind of consciousness. But somehow mud got thrown into your water somewhere along the line. And we try to, you know, first time we try to get back to that purity, we often just stir up the mud. We start shaking things around, and maybe analysis, self-analysis, just stirs up the mud. So Buddhist meditation is quite frequently the first approach is serenity, is settling, allowing the hindrances. The five hindrances are given as things which distort the water, the lucid water-like quality of the mind. So the Buddha gives five similes of the mind as water. Anger is heat added to the water, and when you see pure water, when it's truly pure, you see clearly right to the bottom. You can see everything involved in the Thank you for the side effects there. It's kind of a watery kind of gluck, gluck. Oh, yeah. Okay. Another synchronicity, Chuck. Talking about water, clink. So, yeah, you have to notice these things. They're happening all the time. Well, I'll take this opportunity for it. So, the mind is lucid intrinsically in its original nature, lucid, transparent, and is defiled in some ways by these hindrances. And the first is anger. And it is like water that is when it boils. So you lose the capacity to see through. When it boils, it distorts through all these bubbles and so forth. What is the remedy for that? Turn down the heat. Your mind will return to its lucid condition. There's excess heat energy in anger, which distorts the capacity to see. You can't see. When you're angry, what you see is a distorted fault. It's a fault which is magnified and distorted, not correctly viewed because of the anger. The fault might be in yourself, the fault might be in others, but it's not representative of truth because it's exaggerated and emphasized and taken out of proportion. Notice that when anger goes, that you see the picture in a different way. You're no longer, perhaps you still see that a person has a fault, or you see that you have a fault. However, it's viewed without it's viewed wisely rather than unwisely. So when you have anger connected to the observation of a fault, you're viewing the fault unwisely, and it tends to distort. So it's exaggerated, it's out of proportion, improperly addressed. Now, if you trust the anger and you make judgments based on the anger and you speak in the anger, then you will later on, when your lucidity returns and when your calmness or your goodwill returns, you will then regret what you said and what you did. Anger is also quite, it has a parallel with intelligence in that its capacity to sustain attention on something. So intelligence is the ability to pay attention in class. So the little guys that in grade 2 that can't, you know, they need the Ritalin, can't do the math because they can't even hear what's being said, so they can't pay attention. But if they could pay attention, they could do the math. But one who's keen and intelligent and emotionally untroubled, they're fascinated with the math, and they can do the math and sustain attention over it, and they get an A at the end of it. Anger is like that. It's parallel, but unfortunately, it has strong capacity to pay attention to a fault in a sustained, enduring way. So it has a good concentration capacity. All you can see is the fault. You can see it now, 10 minutes from now, an hour from now, a day from now. You can see it in your dreams. You can see it when you wake up. It's parallel to a remarkable quality of attention, isn't it? Yeah. Unwise attention to the fault. So the Buddha calls it unwise attention to the fault. It distorts everything. It's intelligent in that, so you can list off the faults too. So if you are angry and you're talking about your friend's faults or your husband or wife, or you can rhyme off those faults in very, very kind of cutting way. Nuanced faults. So they say, speak in anger, you'll make the best speech you ever regretted. So we need to turn down the heat. If we want to see lucidly, we need to turn down the heat. We do need to keep our capacity to pay attention. So concentration is a very, very good thing. And sustained attention is a good thing. Even if we see a fault, sustained attention, but wisely sustaining attention, which means that it's devoid of this distorting characteristic of anger. The other opposite of that is desire, and that is oil on the surface of water. So if you're down at the lake in the summer and these motorboats running around, you see that little sheen of rainbow colors on the surface of the water. Of course, it's pollution, isn't it? You don't want to dive into the rainbow, do you? Because it's gas. It's boat gas on the surface of the water, but you cannot see. It's quite beautiful. You can stare at it for quite some time. It's quite gorgeous. And when you look at your reflection in it, you're all colored in rainbows. And that's not what you look like. It's not what anything looks like. But when you put on rainbow-colored glasses, everything is kind of like the big rock candy mountain. But you may find out that it doesn't taste like so good, or there's a problem with it. So in this case, distortion occurs as unwise attention to the beautiful. This is less problematic than anger and is very intrinsic to humans. However, it still does keep us in a state of lack. When we're feeling discontent, when we're feeling that we don't have enough, that we want, is a state of lack. And we cannot be at ease. We've been booted out of the garden. We just cannot be in the garden. Why? I just feel like, why is life so dry? Because we're full of desire, and the moment one wants, one lacks. So this is the relationship. So, and that thing that you want, how do you clarify that, return it to clear water? You know, so you've gone through phases where you wanted something, and then you finally got it, and then you think, well, and you know, this is that, I wonder why I wanted that so bad. You're looking back on what you wanted as a teenager and so forth. There aren't too many teenagers in this room, are there? This is who I should be talking to, actually, is teenagers, because saved yourself a lot of trouble. But it's never too late. This is never too late. Exactly that. We could have saved, looking back, all the things we wanted, things we thought we needed, things we must have to be happy. You know how many times do we think back and say, oh, that was, see, I couldn't understand it. But so that's what's the problem with the hindrances and the distortion of the mind. That's the beautiful. There are other lesser hindrances. Those are the two dominant ones, the ones to keep an eye on. And these are when I talk about dismiss and replace, when we're doing the breath meditation, dismiss and replace, when those kind of, those two dominant hindrances come into the mind, the anger, the tendency to, a little boiling starts, or the wavy, beautiful rainbow oil effect on the surface, those are to be dismissed. And if they resist, then you have to replace, they're the dominant two of the five hindrances. The others are agitation and its opposite, you know, heaviness or even depression, kind of heavy feelings, heavy bodily and emotional feelings, tired, fatigued, and then doubt. They have similar little beautiful similes given by the Buddha, the distortion, the mind when agitated, when you cannot settle down, you cannot feel, it's not a matter of desire, it's not a matter of anger, just restless, cannot be at ease in your own skin. And this is, the water is being blown by wind, so you see the surface of the water has waves and choppy excess energy. So we have to practice again and again, just calming ourselves down so that we don't believe in this just restless energy. It's not going anywhere, but it is preventing you from seeing clearly. You cannot see that the present moment is okay, it's fine. Your life is okay. You can be at ease now. This restless energy is distorting your capacity to see clearly into your own mind, you know, and into reality. Then sloth is where water is stagnant. And you'll see that again, where there's marshes and stagnant water, where there's not enough oxygen. So, of course, energy is required to infuse into the mind. And that's what we do walking meditation, we take deep breaths, we splash cold water on our face, we look up at the sky, we get light in our eyes, we pinch our ears. You don't do that? It's a tip from the Buddha. Pinch your earlobes. It'll make yourself, wake yourself up. You can, I don't know, it must be a like, what are the Chinese? Do they do the acupressure with your earlobes? change the topic. And maybe if you're tired, you're doing breath meditation. It's a very subtle and not so exciting. It can be very exciting if you find your way into deep serenity, but it can be, you might need to switch the topic to sort of discursive activity, raising loving kindness or investigating on a topic to give yourself more energy to recognize that you're not getting enough oxygen, perhaps literally, but anyway, it's a simile for water that is stagnant and you cannot see clearly in that. And the last one is doubt. And doubt is that you just cannot see clearly an answer, a decisive answer, and that's mud. And how do you treat that? What's the first one? Lots of people come to me and have an interview, and they got all these problems, and they don't know how to resolve it. So they ask me about this. What should I do? So mostly the first remedy, very important for doubt in life, is to not to try to resolve the question, the doubt, not to resolve it, but to dissolve it. So first, you don't try to solve the problem. You say, there's a lot of mud here. I think I'm going to stop shaking this glass. What if I just left it alone and let the mud settle? And so that I could, it will return to its original nature. So the mind has an original nature, which is lucid, pure, but is being affected because the mud is being stirred. And so the appropriate thing there is to stop the activity of the mind. So you're actually very quickly, before you understand it, you're actually creating doubts out of nothing, problems out of nothing, and no wonder they can't be resolved, because it's the mind is just it's starting to trigger by itself. It's going in a circle and creating more and more and more and more doubts. So the thing is not to answer the question, because the question maker is just running off the tracks, that's all. And so we have to say, okay, now is the time not to answer these questions, but to practice serenity, to see if I can dissolve these questions. And about 95% should be dissolvable. And when you really become calm, clear, lucid, then you ask yourself, now what was that problem again? Yeah, I can't remember what it was. Right, there wasn't any problem. I didn't find the answer to it because there really wasn't a problem. But perhaps there is something that you need to resolve in your life. Occasionally, questions need to be answered, decisions need to be made, and those are doubt. And so then the proper thing is, so first, you put it through the process of calming. So it's dissolving. Anything remaining then, the treatment for doubt is to get more information. And so you would visit people who know more about it than you, and you would ask some questions. We call it knowing where the water holes are. Where you get your, otherwise you're going to be wandering around thirsty. So water holes are wise people or people with expertise in some worldly area. If you want to know about how to fix your car, you go to a mechanic, go to a doctor, etc. Spiritual questions, you go to wise friends. And so these are all treatments so that the mind can return to its original nature, which is cool and clear and lucid, nature of wisdom and emotional. It returns to its original nature. You can never lose that. That's inherent in the nature of the mind. The mind itself is not personal and has a universal quality of this. So the hindrances are not intrinsically you. It's not you're just the way you are. It's to do with the structures of consciousness, and they have universal kind of principles, and they all can be resolved. And there's nothing personal about being angry or being greedy or being sad or anything. It's not personal. And the mind also can become lucid and transcend these things as well. So that's the purpose of the meditation and the gardening exercises. Finding our way back to the coolness of being at ease in nature. So the Buddha is spending the rest of his life at Bodhi, in nature, at ease. When I first heard about the Buddha, I learned about the lifestyle of. He awakened, and then he spent the next 45 years in the forest meditating and giving advice and stuff. And I thought, I try to imagine. How would that be? Like, did he have any hobbies? Or how do you spend your life under a tree without going crazy, you know? Like, all day? I could see it for a day, maybe an afternoon. But, a week, a month, a year? What? How does a human not do any have to do anything? How is it possible that somebody could be I thought I might be missing something from the story, even though, but it's a curious thing. It really assaults the mind. I remember as a kid thinking, I don't know why this came into my mind, but I remember the thought, I'd heard about monks, not Buddhist monks but Christian monks, and I thought, I must have, I don't know, probably was 9 or something like this, 10, maybe 11. And I don't know why this came into my mind, but I thought, what do they do all day? And, you know, I'd seen a few movies where there's monks in it or whatever. They're kind of background side effects of Robin Hood or, something is going on and there's monks in the background. You can't make a movie about monks. It's there's no drama there. There's no boy meets girl, boy loses girl. Monk doesn't meet girl, monk never gets girl, monk doesn't care about the girl, monk spends the rest of his life in a cell. I think it's so mysterious to me. Like, what do they do all day? And I think it must be a past life kind of memory. Like, why would I feel... I'd never seen a monk, and I'm not raised in any kind of religious structures or anything. What am I thinking about? What would those guys do all day? And I can imagine them walking back and forth and so forth, and I finally decided that they must just be. They're not doing anything, they're just being in it. I thought, so, yeah, well, why not? Why couldn't you just be, it perplexed me. I think I felt kind of like I'd kind of answered a question, but it remained a mystery. Like, what would that? How can you do that as a human? Because for my life, it was like, okay, I can wait here on the corner for the bus for about 15 minutes, but after that, I got to be doing something, So it's doing and being this kind of, can a person be well, happy, peaceful, at ease? Is that allowed? This sounds like, feels like it violates a lot of basic laws of nature, doesn't it? But apparently you can. And that's a discovery. If we can find that, now it doesn't mean that we never do anything or it's wrong to do things. Doing is necessity of human lives. We need to do things. We need to feed ourselves, to wash ourselves, to walk here, walk there, and do a few things. We do them because they're necessary to do, but not humans don't do it that way, do they? Their lives are full of actions that are not exactly necessary. They're just, well, if you really question somebody, they can't really answer. There's a kind of a, there's no other vision of life than that you must be continuously engaged in action, and that the idea of being, pure just being, at ease, without the feeling of anxiety or despair or something, it's not something that we normally know about. But that's if we ever want to get off the relentless wheel of action, of pure action, of going somewhere to go and end up going somewhere from there, to go somewhere from there, to go somewhere from there, to go right, never seems to end. Is there any way off that wheel? So that's one way of talking. We talk about the wheel of becoming and so forth. This is the wheel of becoming through endless, trying to find another reason to get through the end, to the end of the day, to the end of the week or so forth. It's not motivations. But if we could, can we step off that into the present from eternally pushing into the future? So this is the training of the mind. And the we don't have to, if when you think about it, sometimes it used to bother me. Like, I think, what, how would that be, Then I say, okay, just never mind, just meditate. Yeah, you'll see, you'll find out, maybe. So that's the way to, when we are perplexed by the idea of what would being be rather than doing, we just set it aside and more or less, we'll see. Maybe it'll all become clear. But we need to go back to the breath and do these things. So this is the process, and we call it gardening. We are making to become, and also making a lot of decisions continuously. Accurate decisions about what's going on in our mind. Are we investing in becoming, or are we allowing ourselves to be? Recognizing when we're distorting through ill will, anger. Recognizing when we're distorting through desire and craving. So, allowing these things to go to lucidity and clarity. Yeah. So our afternoon just devoted to clarity. And allowing these, if you encounter the hindrances, and you will through the afternoon, just recognize them, name them, start to get good. Oh, sloth. That's what that is. Doubt, agitation, ill will, desire, and then letting them, dismissing and replacing them. And recognizing perhaps the positive things. I'm feeling expansive. I'm feeling generous. Feeling kindly. I'm feeling very relaxed and not without fear. This is a very beautiful, and that's to be maintained and deepened. So we're using breath, we're using various other things to help us ground ourselves, but that's the bigger work, the larger work, the wisdom work is that in the background. It's going on in the background.